So let me get this started. Welcome everyone to this work session. I'm actually really excited that we're having this conversation, this discussion this morning with a team that have been working hard on a big idea. Let me set the context from my point of view, and it's one of the reasons why I am so excited about this. There are moments that come along in the history of the city where we get to either drift or paddle and make a huge choice in whether we do that. And let me explain a little better. If you've ever been to the San Juans, you know, it's kind of foggy, and you can sort of see these islands in the distance. And imagine yourself being out there in a canoe, and in that fog, you can see these half-formed destinations. And if you're in that canoe in that situation, you can drift because there's a big tide, and you will get somewhere. But you can also paddle towards a destination. And that's what this feels like to me. That's what this issue about the post office feels like to me, that there is a current of change, and we can try to take our own direction in it, or we can just let it sweep us along. And we have been here before, and I can think of three very specific instances when we've been in this situation and where I've been involved. One was the Pearl District. You know, now the Pearl District looks inevitable. Looks like it was always that way or supposed to be that way. But the initial plan for the Pearl District was essentially cruiseway north, a mostly auto-oriented, mostly office, low-scale district that would have been a very pale imitation of what we got because we did paddle and steer towards a different destination. We said, let's build the streetcar. Let's change the plan. Let's raise the level of urban design. Let's plan some parks. And created a whole new urban neighborhood. And again, that wasn't accidental, that wasn't drift, that wasn't inevitable. Very much the same thing happened with the South Waterfront and OHSU. OHSU had a huge piece of property in the suburbs, at one time called the Oregon Graduate Institute, where they figured they were running out of land on the hill and they were going to have to expand, and so they were going to expand in the suburbs. And then meanwhile, we were caught with our planning down and were presented with a permit application for a 10-acre gated community in what's now a chunk of the South Waterfront. And we very quickly paddled and steered towards a different plan for the South Waterfront. And obviously we're now benefiting from that every day as the OHSU Night Challenge effort starts to build out and as the rest of that effort bears fruit. But the idea of building a tram and organizing the expansion of OHSU and the development of a new neighborhood there was a risky proposition, just like the Pearl District was. And then so likewise with Airport Light Rail and Cascade Station. We would have gotten some development out there. There would have been some warehouses and some trucks, and people would have gotten to the airport one way or another. In fact, what got me started on that issue was a newspaper story about the port's plan for $150 million worth of parking garages as their transportation plan. And I was sitting in Steve's shoes at that point as transportation commissioner, or standing in Steve's shoes at that point saying, wait a minute, we can do better than that. That's crazy. Why are we talking only about $150 million worth of parking garages at the airport? And so, again, we created a plan for the place that was very different than where we would have gotten to if we just drifted. And that's, again, I'm using that analogy purposefully because to do nothing is a decision, to wait is a decision, particularly in this case. And Patrick and the team will outline that. There are only a couple of places that can accommodate the United States Postal Service if this move can be accomplished. Those places will not be available in the future. So we have a moment in which we can steer towards a destination, but it won't necessarily come back around again. So there's a risk to drift, and there's a risk to go. In this case, I think it's both prudent and the Portland thing to do to go towards this destination of thoughtful redevelopment of this site and the relocation of the post office. We will be able to choose between doing something or waiting and hoping, and I like doing something much more. So I really want to thank and appreciate this team that have put this idea together and have gotten it to the point where it's time for us to start really bearing down on it and giving some direction to the team and ultimately making formal decisions in this chamber to make it happen. So with that, Mr. Quinton.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Hales. Good morning, commissioners. We really do appreciate the opportunity to have this work session and dig into the deal as we know it now, and it is a deal in formation, so there are some things that are left to be worked out, but we think it's a good time to check in with you. I am joined here by Lisa Alwoff, who is our Central City Manager. So her team is project managing this. On the PDC side, we're also joined by Tony Barnes, who's our budget officer. This is a very substantial kind of financial decision to be made here, and so Tony's team's been working on it. There's an audience is full of many other PDC folks. This is all hands on for PDC. As you heard from the mayor, we believe this is a significant opportunity worthy of a lot of staff time. So we have all sorts of people working on it, and to the extent that your questions can't be answered by anyone at this table, we'll bring them up to the table. As the presentation outlines, we want to start. I want to get into a little bit more detail on the opportunity, why this is the moment. So we're going to talk about why it's now versus and the option really is to do nothing because we don't have other opportunities to make this happen, and then walk you through the timeline so you understand what you know how this plays out. We're making decisions now that will result in actions a few years out. And then I'm going to turn it over to Lisa, who has, along with Sarah Harpole here, led a very truncated framework planning process to give us not just an initial vision and concept for what might be on the site, but also to help inform the assumptions that drive the financing question that we'll present to you. And so then I'm joined here by Ken Rust. You all know Ken very well, the city CFO, who will walk you through the city's potential role in helping us finance this. And so one of the big questions that's different about this transaction is that PDC can't finance this alone through tax increment financing. We actually need help from the city. And so Ken is going to outline a concept that we've been working on that would allow the city to come in and help us make this happen. And then we'll talk about the second stage of that money question is, okay, then what can happen on the site and how we pay for it, and we can talk about the money, and then obviously what we would love to have both throughout the conversation but also at the end is your feedback and questions, what information you need, what questions you need answered if we're going to come back to you for a formal decision. So in terms of the why now, I'll run through this. I think much of this is you work through a lot of these topics on a regular basis, so you know, but just a big picture, this is a city and a region that's projected to grow substantially. And so that growth has to go somewhere. We see the issues of supply of land and development daily, whether it be housing or office space or industrial space or institutional space for institutions to grow. And so this is a unique opportunity in that sense to be in control of a substantial amount of land in the central city that could accommodate a decent chunk of what we project to be growth in new households and jobs in the city. And if you were to think about this from a perspective of what would it mean for us to accommodate this kind of growth in a less dense, less central location, it would require roughly, if you have this kind of growth somewhere on the outside of downtown, roughly 400 acres of land compared to 13 acres of land that we're talking about, and the infrastructure costs are 2.5 times what it would cost. So this is a basic density argument here. It doesn't imply that all the growth is going to be absorbed downtown as we grow as a city, but it does require downtown to absorb a substantial portion of it. And this allows us to do that in a cost-effective manner, to leverage the investments we've already made in our central city around infrastructure, transportation, those things. As the mayor also touched on, the moment that we have now is largely driven by the circumstances around the United States Postal Service. If we are going to locate them, we do need to have another location in mind. This region is, as I mentioned, constrained by industrial space as well as other forms of space. So we need to find a place for them now, and the choices will be very different if we undertake this 5-10 years from now. The bigger issue, and I think this is one that continues to create confusion as we talk about this deal with various audiences, is that the Postal Service will not undertake this move on their own. So they will not put the property out to market, at least not in the foreseeable future. It could be for another generation that they hold on to this property. They don't have the ability, without substantial process, to put it out to a private buyer that would go through, like the city, would go through formal government services administration, GSA type of process in which they would put it out for bid and whatnot. They have 34,000 properties in their portfolio in the United States. They have a pipeline of projects they're working on their own of surplus properties. This is not on the list. So they can deal with us directly. They can accept an offer from another public entity, but they will not on their own undertake any kind of offer to sell this to the private sector in the foreseeable future. So we're not choosing between right now us doing this or letting the private sector do this. We're choosing right now about whether we, using our unique position as a public entity, will facilitate the transition of this property from an entirely public use that will remain as is into a use that will allow for all sorts of development that we can imagine. And then the last thing on the moment, on the why this moment, and Ken can get into this as well, is that let's assume that we say, you know, the city can't really do this now. Let's do this 5 years from now. The city can do this 10 years from now. The city right now has the tools available to it through tax increment financing in the River District and the ability to augment that in an incremental amount that probably won't exist 5 years from now. We can see how the River District is going to spend down. We know the life of this district. We know how much time we have left to issue debt in the River District. So once that goes away, the city would have to undertake this absent new urban renewal. And we know how those conversations have gone. Absent new urban renewal, the city's not likely to have the resources at its disposal to make this happen, or it would be a very different kind of conversation in terms of what kind of risk the city is willing to take. So for all those reasons, in addition to the big reason of this is just a very strategic site that will allow the city to be in control of a big chunk of downtown's destiny, all these reasons speak to why now is the time for us to do it. And because we have been actively working on this with the Postal Service and demonstrating our willingness to move forward in this transaction, we do have a very willing partner on the other end who is dedicating their own resources to trying to make this transaction happen. So if you look at the schedule that we're under, we're going to put before you decisions that we make now that will largely result in things happening a few years from now. But right now, this quarter, we are attempting to complete negotiations with the United States Postal Service on the acquisition of this site and help them identify a new site and acquire that site and begin construction on that. So that agreement will come before our board this quarter, this fall, assuming that we have the go-ahead on financing and the framework plan. The framework plan that Lisa is going to talk to you about has been completed. That'll be presented to council. Council will, in reviewing that, will be giving kind of a high-level green light on, yes, these are the type of assumptions that we want to see in future development on the site. But as you can see, if we move forward in this transaction, we will come back in terms of the completion of the Central City 2035 plan and any potential development on the site. We will come back with a master plan for this site. It's actually part of the West Quad plan. So there'll be a master plan that comes back to the City Council within some time frame, depending on development. And then in 2016, we'll also the post office will actually be moving forward on the construction of a new facility. So they'll put it out for bid in the spring and hopefully begin construction sometime within the next 12 months. And then that process, you can see, will take another 2 years for them to complete that. We will be able to then take possession of the property during that time frame and then complete the master plan and then put it out for solicitation. Post office was relocated by the end of 2018, and then we're in 2019 and beyond is when you would see new development happening on the post office site. So that's the time frame we're talking about here. It fits in a normal development time frame, so there's nothing extraordinary either way about that. But as you see, it does allow us the time to both plan this in a way that meets the priorities of the city, but also allows us to make the best use of the dollars that are available to us. If we were to try to do this all in the next 12 months, it would create a significant issue in terms of cash flow. This allows us to actually to really space out our investments in the property and try and match them up with proceeds back in the transaction, and Ken can talk about that. So before I turn it over to Lisa, I just want to set the kind of stage for the framework conversation, because what's pretty much probably any decision you make, any development decision in particular, you're trading off things. You always have competing priorities. And in this project, it's no different. But the stakes become higher when you're talking about a project of this magnitude. And so we obviously have the main reason why we want to acquire this site, which is what can be there. And we can imagine so much that can be there. And whether it be a large institutional user, whether it be to meet our affordable housing needs, whether it be to finish the park blocks or create connectivity between the Pearl District and Union Station, all these things are the reasons why we would want to be in the ownership of this property. And along the way, we would make sure that the public benefits that came to the city of Portland, to the residents of Portland, were commensurate with the size of this transaction. But because of the way we have to acquire it, because of the amount of resources that are being put into it, we have to balance out the need to get a return to the city so that we can pay for repay debt that we've borrowed to make this happen, but also so that we can make the investments in the infrastructure and the affordable housing and open space that we'd like to make here. So the framework plan is an attempt to balance those issues, both in a conceptual way, but also in a real kind of financial way. And so, and as you get to a decision point on this, that's going to be part of, I think, the consideration, which is how much of this site can we devote to public benefit, and what does that do to the risk the city would have to take on this? And it's obviously a spectrum, but it does have trade-offs. So with that, unless there are any questions about what I've presented so far, I'm going to turn it to Lisa, who's going to walk through the framework plan that we've just completed.
Okay. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. So we'll start with a little bit of policy context, just kind of where we've been in the past 3 months in terms of the direction that came to PDZ coming from the West Quadrant Plan. So in addition to the opportunity of our ongoing conversations with the post office, the West Quadrant Plan did specify for this particular site particular goals around development, and also that PDZ kind of move towards acquiring and controlling the site, and that ultimately that would result in a master plan for the site. So the West Quadrant Plan does call for a master plan for the site. That is something that you will see come back before you as part of Central City 2035. And as I walk through the framework plan, you can really think about the framework plan as starting to set the foundation for what some of those requirements and or goals of a master plan would be, and how financially feasible, how can we track those costs and those sources coming off of the site. So as Patrick mentioned, the framework plan did actually take a look at a broader area than just the post office site, and we did that quite intentionally because PDZ does own a number of parcels adjacent to the site. Many of them are occupied and tenanted, so they're not going to change over time. So we do own Union Station. We own the building that PNCA is in, but there are also parcels where there's opportunity in the future, and so that's what you see here in terms of what we call Block Y, which is the surface parking lot across from Union Station. We own Block R, which is a full block. And then we have had active discussions with Greyhound that has indicated an interest in the potential to relocate into a different facility, allowing for that site to redevelop in the future. So we did take a look at the broader site. We then, if you turn to the next slide, we did a pretty extensive public outreach process, albeit a pretty rapid-paced one, from June to just this past 2 weeks. So we had a final open house on September 8th. We had both a technical advisory committee as well as a stakeholder advisory committee. So I thank you for your staff's time, because we actually had staff from across all of our bureaus pretty engaged, both at the framework plan level and then looking at opportunities for the post office site. We hosted three public open houses that were very, very well attended through in Old Town, Chinatown, and then in the Pearl. And then desiring to actually want to get feedback from folks out in the community who may not come to those events, we actually did an intercept survey at Overlook Park during Movies in the Park night. We went out along light rail where this terminates and started to think about who may be arriving into downtown by way of Union Station. This is ultimately kind of their gateway into Portland, the central city of Portland. And then we did also strategically kind of push out to, again, broaden input via an online survey together with the Oregonians Health in terms of asking for public feedback around density, program, public realm design, et cetera, for that broader area. We received, through that outreach, we received about 1,000 points of feedback. So this wasn't just kind of folks we talked to, but actually input that we gathered back. And these are some of the major themes that you see that we received back. One, I think there was a lot of intrigue with the opportunity for additional density and growth. So this is going to be an important piece as we walk through the post office site to contemplate. It's actually today, it's zoned at 4-1 FAR. And I think when we've looked at it, both from a development perspective as well as a financial perspective, starting to understand what are the public benefits we would want to see and what's the urban form we would want to see if we allowed for that site to go to higher density. But there was a lot of interest, particularly at the bridgehead, similar to what was discussed as part of the West Quad process, to provide good bicycle and pedestrian connections, both between Old Town, Chinatown, and Union Station as a regional hub up into the Pearl, but also this site offers the opportunity. The Green Loop came before you as part of the West Quad plan. This site does back into that Broadway Y and thinking about how the Green Loop could actually transect and hit the North Park blocks in a unique way if we did control this site for public improvements. Create visual and physical links to Union Station. So clearly this is kind of a landmark for Portland and thinking about it in that way. And then last but not least, we did a lot of what came out clearly in some of our early outreach was that the public realm was going to be one of the key priorities should the public invest in this area. And understanding what kind of public spaces, whether it's in front of Union Station or it's via parks, would work for the region at large and would attract folks from Outer East Portland or Outer West Portland to come and use the parks in this particular location. And what you see, the visual to the right is actually we did in-situ kind of boards asking people for their feedback. So the next slide is, again, at that higher framework plan level for all of the properties, starting to think about how the different buildings and places could engage. And three major new kind of public realm opportunities came out of that conversation with the public. One is thinking about kind of a more urban plaza form that could occur in front of Union Station and capture the activity of folks coming on mass transit and or regional transit to that location. One is around Cascade Walk, which again leverages the whole concept of what's happening at the Broadway Y. Another thing that's interesting and unique about this site is you actually have kind of this elevation change that you have to navigate between the North Park blocks and where it hits the Lovejoy ramp and Broadway ramp. And how do you leverage those opportunities in terms of under the Broadway and also kind of coming down under the Broadway ramp and then coming down off of the Broadway bridge? And last but not least, I think it's something that clearly has been out there as part of the West Quadrant plan, et cetera, around thinking about how would this site leverage and support the North Park blocks as a signature site for Portland. So the next slide kind of takes you rapidly through the public outreach and development and design efforts that we underwent over the past 4 months. So working with a design team led by ZGF and SOM, we actually went out with five high-level concepts, which is what you see on the left-hand side of the slide. They were called Cascade, Station, Stitch, Innovation, Weave. They really thought differently about density on the site, height of development on the site, and the public realm. We then, based on the public survey and public feedback that I referenced, we then shortened it to three distinct options, which is what you see in employment emphasis, balanced emphasis, and residential emphasis. Again, if you kind of think about the framework plan as much about testing feasibility of development on the site and the public return relative to the public costs, these were different programs and different public realm assumptions based on what we had heard feedback on in the prior five. So the employment emphasis really looked at a much heavier office use from a development phasing and a development type on the site. Balance was kind of split between office and residential, and then residential really emphasized residential units in term. And what you see in the preferred, which we'll cover in further detail, so you'll have more slides than just this, is the balanced hit, I think, a lot of goals for the city, both in terms of the kind of place that it created financially, but also thinking about a jobs to residential ratio that looked more like the CBD. So we heard a lot from the adjacent communities, the desire for a mixed use opportunity on the post office site, given a heavier residential presence, both in Old Town, Chinatown, and in the Pearl District. So what you have on the next slide is sure.
The once upon a time, a local designer referred to the space in front of PNCA as potentially the ankle that then pivoted the park north. In your conceptual design, it goes due north. It doesn't rotate to sort of connect to the extent feasible with the existing parks in the River District. Was that intentional?
It actually does along Johnson, and you'll see there's a view. So the way what we have it pivoting right now is Johnson, and you can actually see it in the next slide. The two major public right-of-way streets would actually be Johnson and Park Avenue. So you would pivot. Johnson is also a green street, so you would actually pivot at Johnson into the Pearl sequence of parks. But you also have the opportunity of the green loop to pivot up and over Broadway. And then if you look, there's been a lot of contemplation of also how do you pivot actually under Broadway to Union Station. So the next slide, again, kind of understanding this at a framework level. So we're not at a master plan level. We haven't contemplated which parcels would carry what program, what those buildings would look like, et cetera. This was really truth testing how much of the site could be divided between public realm and private development, what kind of height density of development would receive kind of public support relative to the public benefits. And so where we landed throughout those kind of scenarios that I ran through was that this was the framework, literally the framework that any master plan would start with in terms of the urban design for the site. So streets, we looked at Johnson Street and Park Avenue as the major public rights of way. We did look at them as 80 feet right away versus 60 feet right away, which is how they're designated today. We looked at two additional park blocks, both thinking about how do they connect to the north park blocks, but also thinking about how would they connect again under the Broadway overpass back to Union Station. We looked at the green loop, and then the assumption that we ran with is we modeled a 25% dedication of residential FAR to affordable housing. And the reason we chose that versus we know there's a goal for the Central City 2035 plan around 30% was because we were holding an entitlement conversation of 4-1 up to 7-1. We were modeling a lot of the policy conversation that was underway around 25% of base FAR would be committed to affordable housing as you think about FAR bonuses differently in the future for the Central City.
So you have a lot of FAR you would propose to transfer to this site, don't you?
We do. We have about 1.6 that could come off of Union Station and PNCA if the transfer development rights code stays as it is today.
So you just pointed out this doesn't reconcile with the Central City plan, a goal of 30%. The River District has achieved about a 34% affordable housing, and council will shortly be considering proposals to increase the dedication of TIF above 30%. So this seems a little speculative and a little light on affordable housing commitment.
Yeah, so we're going to, so later in the presentation, we're going to get into the kind of financial side of it. I don't think this is necessarily the end of the conversation on it. This is dedicating the FAR, so it's basically the land banking piece of the affordable housing strategy for this site. You still have a resource conversation that we need to have. So this is trying to maximize the number of units that we can get out of development here, but we still have to match up what the financing piece of it is, and we can show you that. And then we can talk about how to allocate resources to get whatever outcome. The other thing is this is in addition to the current set aside in the River District. So this would take this, you know, the amount of investment in the River District from, it's in low 30s now to a much higher number. So it's incremental to what's already happening in the River District. So you know, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, but we can bring it all together and we talk about the dollars, because there's still subsidy needed to get whatever units are allocated out of the FAR. This is about 600 units of new affordable housing that is being space is being allocated for that.
And the other thing, just kind of before we dive into the preferred, what you will see is this was a development model. So it's also, we needed to kind of, we moved forward with a model that said this was the size of rights of way, this is the size of parks, this is kind of an assumption of affordable housing, and then said, how does that financially perform relative to the conversation that we are also undertaking with the Office of Management and Financing around financing the acquisition of the site. So it's not a site that we own today. It certainly needs to go through a master plan process based on this framework plan, and there's additional work to be done. So what you have on the next two slides, and this kind of is the one that I was referencing in terms of thinking about how the North Park blocks intentionally up Johnson would connect back to Jameson Park, Tanner, et cetera, and then how it connects to Union Station. So again, one of the things that we heard very loudly from the community around making sure that Johnson is very intentionally designed for bikes, pedestrians, auto, et cetera, traffic, and is the major connection from Union Station west was Johnson Street, which is why we did run an assumption that carried an 80-foot right-of-way versus a 60-foot right-of-way. On the next slide, you have kind of the rendering of how do we start to think about both connections under the Broadway Bridge between Union Station and the post office site, but also how would you come down off of the Broadway Bridge, why, knowing that it's a major connector up into the east side of Portland for folks coming into work or coming to visit the central city. The next slide gives you a program mix of what we modeled. And again, it's a model in terms of breakdown between medical, institutional, retail, et cetera. And it is about two-thirds residential, one-third office. So if you harken back to kind of where we were truth-testing in terms of financial performance, development capacity, and what kind of form could be achieved, this was someplace between the residential emphasis and the balanced. It does actually have a higher, based on a 7-to-1 FAR, it does actually have a higher jobs per acre ratio than the Pearl District, certainly, and it comes on par with the CBD. So it's something that we are carrying as kind of a measure for the future development assumptions as we get into measures of success. And then I think kind of the last thing to flag is we did, working with PBOT, we worked with PBOT in terms of our ratio assumptions and then striving for about a 20% shared parking opportunity, which is allowed when you combine the office and the residential.
How tall is the tower you penciled in here, and how does it compare to either the tower that's going up in the River District or a comparable building down there?
Sure, it's about 400 feet. Nolan's here, he can correct me. And that was something, it's certainly kind of pushing the envelope.
Give us a...
It's about the U.S., the big pink park tower.
A little lower than that. Okay. A little taller than the one at the head of the fields.
Yeah.
A little shorter than U.S.
Park Avenue West, is it similar? Or
Yeah.
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 Well,
So then one of the applications of the development program in density is we worked with a financial analysis group to say, what is the residual land value? So if we're acquiring the site from the post office, what can the public then have the capacity to invest in the site, and what can we source off of eventual sales of the property that we've bought? And so they did it via a residual land value analysis where they looked at the different types of uses going into the site. They said, what kind of value will that create for the private sector over time? And then they translated that back. It's a bit unique. It's not on a per square feet of land or per acre of land. It's actually on per square feet of developable value. It does. We also did assume, because we heard this strongly from various folks in the community, to keep the post office building and the existing garage during phase one. I think there was strong support for that, both from how quickly could this site be developed, but also from the goal of leveraging kind of existing resources to the maximum extent possible on the site.
What would you do?
For office, so the post office site, the post office building could be used for rehabbed and used for office, and the garage would continue to serve parking.
And then eventually
yes, so we'll walk through phasing. So the residual land value analysis resulted in, for market rate residential, it translates into about 55 to 65 per square foot of development FAR. We did assume that 25% of that residential would be run at kind of no value, no cost to a private entity, and ultimately it would be reserved, similar to kind of buying land for PHB. And then the commercial was translated into about 25 to 35 per square foot of FAR. Based on the preferred program, another kind of consideration as we thought about program split was how quickly could this really develop? And based on this preferred program, it has about a 20-year absorption, what we would call an absorption, and it would probably happen over two or three development cycles. And so reflective of that, we have one land sale projected for 2022, and one modeled for 2526. That's true.
We project conservatively.
We do project conservatively. So coming off of those initial findings in terms of residual land value, that framework for balance between private development, public realm, et cetera, these were the high-level recommendations. Again, similar if you think about kind of high-level recommendations around what's the density, what's the right balance of form, which was to pursue a mix of employment and residential uses based on the Central City 2035 plan, that there was an opportunity based on reusing the post office and the garage to actually emphasize residential use in phase one because it also generates the most resources, knowing that we want to accomplish public benefit in phase one, and so you'll see there's a significant emphasis on residential in phase one. To coordinate infrastructure and open space improvements with development so that we're not over-investing ahead of private investment, and then to identify strategies for supporting affordable housing. I think as we started to see the results relative to 25%, knowing the goal of 30%, it's certainly something as we'll walk through. Later, we've assumed no system development charges, investing in the public infrastructure. Are there other opportunities to bring down some costs related to parking, et cetera? So you'll have on the next two pages are renderings of conceptually how would development phase based on the interim use of the post office site, of the post office building or some portion thereof, and the garage, and what are the infrastructure improvements that would happen concurrently. So this is similar to what we see on other major land parcels where we develop first and foremost adjacent to the infrastructure that we've already invested in and build phased infrastructure with phased development. So the dark blue is what could be developed as part of phase one. Again, phase one was modeled to have a pretty heavy residential presence. So it's about 1,200 units. The 25% of FAR would allow for 300 units, again, kind of a model, 100,000 square feet of retail, full or partial reuse of the post office building, and reuse of the existing garage. The other assumption that's important to note, particularly as we think about urban form and as we think about transportation mode options on this site, is we have looked at all parking as being above grade. And we have done that because of the environmental conditions of the site. Development phasing, the phase two is almost a one-to-one balance between residential and commercial, again, with kind of a 25% of FAR occurring modeled as occurring for affordable housing, and that is when you would demolish the post office building and then complete the park block continuation. So coming off of all of that, so if you imagine we have modeled a framework for density, a framework for design, a framework for development program, and public realm. These we then translated into kind of our measures of success relative to what we had heard from the community were goals for the area, which is what you see down below. So around public realm and transportation, clearly a goal of extending the North Park blocks of approximately 2 blocks, looking at the opportunity for what became called kind of exchange place under adjacent to the Broadway ramp so that you offer that connection to Union Station, connection at the Broadway Y, and then knowing there's also a quadrant goal of 20% tree canopy, which based on the rights of way and open space dedication that is modeled to occur in the post office could be accomplished. The pedestrian bike auto connections, looking at Johnson and Park as a multimodal street, so both in terms of thinking about circulation for Union Station, but also thinking about pedestrians and bikes who are connecting through. But both Broadway and Lovejoy are dedicated bikeways, and so thinking about as we trigger adjacent improvements, what can be improved on those bikeways. And this is particularly because on Broadway and Lovejoy, should you be able to control the post office site, you actually have the opportunity to build into adjacent development in a way that you don't have today within the existing right-of-way, and then commute trip goals.
So you have 2 blocks of park mm-hmm. extension, but the block in front of PNCA isn't a park at this point either. Is that factored into the financing to improve that block as well?
It is not factored into the final cost estimate that you'll see we ran, because we tried to run it as a kind of a internal to the post office site relative to the cost of acquisition, cost of public improvements, and then the land value that we would be able to turn around and resell.
I think if there's a vision for the area, it needs to include the block in front of PNCA.
Absolutely.
There isn't parks money to do that.
So in terms of sustainability, one of the other tests that we did as we thought about the balance between programs was the opportunity for savings when you have both commercial use and residential use in a concentrated geography, and what kind of opportunity a site of this size offers for district systems. And so you see some of those goals around reduction in water use, energy use, et cetera, reflected here. And then last but not least.
So you're assuming district heating and cooling, is that what you're
saying? We are not assuming district heating and cooling. Right now what we're assuming is what amount of savings could you accomplish just between kind of sharing. I don't think, Nolan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, in the cost estimates we did not assume a centralized district system.
And, does that bear looking at in terms of achieving sustainability goals and sort of a sound investment? I know we've talked a lot about district heating and cooling over the years, but we seem to fall short on actually doing it.
Yeah, I would say.
This seems like a site prime for that.
Yeah, I think BP, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, I think that's certainly something as we move further into a master plan, they would desire us to look at, particularly given these goals.
And is the water use assumption, are you talking about gray water?
I think it's all water.
Potable water.
Potable water, yeah.
So what's just in two sentences, what are you thinking?
Pretty close to what the Hassalo and 8th project is accomplishing.
I'm not sure what they're accomplishing.
I think that is close.
Yeah. So as we think about the site from who's both who's visiting, but also who's living or working there, again, thinking about a mixed income community. So from a residential perspective, making sure that we have a good balance between affordable, low, and moderate income, but we've also had ongoing conversations with the Housing Bureau about thinking about middle income opportunities on the site and how would we look at the model differently if we were pursuing a particular target related to middle income, so thinking more kind of the 60 to 80 and 60 to 100% median family income units. Thinking about commercial space, so one of the other reasons to keep the post office, particularly the post office building, and reuse the post office building, is it also does offer the opportunity for a lower lease price point office space than new construction would for businesses who are interested in coming into the central city and or the businesses who align with PDC's new strategic plan. Contracting, this reflects PDC's requirement that we place on all of our sizable investments. Job density, this goes back again, kind of being intentional about how many jobs can occur on this site and that it balances the adjacent neighborhoods and fulfills kind of employment goals for the central city. And then return on public investment relative to both private investment leverage that we're then able to put back into some of the public improvement costs, but also over the long term around property tax generation. So it's something that you won't see, I believe, as part of our financial consideration. But it's certainly the property taxes that would come off of this site are not anticipated nor required for the River District bond payoff. So it's something that would be an incremental benefit back to the city. So I'm going to stop there.
Yeah. So we'd next move into the financing side of it. But before we do, we just want to make sure if there are any kind of immediate questions. We obviously can have a more comprehensive conversation about questions at the end.
One question about the program. And this is not a master plan, it's a conceptual plan, but
right.
The notion of a rather large office tower, right, that's the signature building at the terminal vista there of the whole plan, that we're not anticipating the arrival of a new corporate headquarters in Portland, but if there was one, this would be a site for it.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously acquired the site, the timeline that we've laid out, all the things that have to happen, and then you know, in 2018, 2019, you have this 14-acre opportunity. Who knows what the opportunities will be at that point? The framework plan isn't meant to be binding in terms of it locks us in on a use. We probably want to have some binding commitments around public benefits, but yeah, we would adjust as needed if we had a particular use.
Yeah. No one has a secret plan. No one has a secret client. But
no.
I was involved in South Lake Union, and Amazon made their decision, and they moved 4,000 employees to that site because the city created the opportunity. No guarantees that'll happen here. No player to be named later until later, but that's the kind of opportunity this could open.
Right. Yeah, let me just ask a question, because I think we're all someday hoping that a Google or someone knocks on the door and says we want to move our campus to a desirable downtown space. And so if that were to occur, if some major employer came and we weren't able to meet the other public benefit goals that we've established for the district, do we have a plan B which captures the value of the investment the private sector makes with an ironclad commitment that those resources will be invested somewhere else so that we get the equivalent and minimum equivalent benefit somewhere?
Well, I think that's what we want to work out with council as we go forward. What is it that you want to see in terms of a commitment on public benefits so that in different scenarios we can try and accomplish it? And yes, I think the plan B is, to the extent that we, let's just hypothetically sell the whole site to a private user because we think that's the best outcome, and we get a single payment, then what happens with that money? And can those funds be used to basically buy us a comparable set of public benefits? I would still say, I think on affordable housing, I think that is a fundamental question of how do you scenario plan for different things. But from a master planning perspective, whether it's a Google or mixed-use development or whatever, we're still going to want accessibility, street grid, open space, right? So I still think we're gonna we're going to be negotiating those kind of outcomes. But if there's no residential on site, then we can't accomplish affordable housing goals on site. We need to accomplish it elsewhere.
Right. And it reminds me of two recent conversations that provide a context. One is incentive zoning, where Dan has proposed a fee in lieu. And the second is the Zidel development, where, you know, you pointed out that what if someone comes and says we want the entire site, and then how do we make sure that the commitments around parks and affordable housing are met? So I get the idea that you want some flexibility, but I think what you're going to hear, at least from me later, is with that flexibility comes greater certainty as to what affordable housing gets in lieu. Because I think if we learned anything from North McAdam is we have to be very, very crystal clear about what it is. Dollars, sites, timeline, and it can't just be in the ether.
So we're going to move to the financing plan. I'm going to turn it over to Ken in a second. I just want to, we went through this whole framework plan, obviously, to begin to have this conversation about what can happen on the site. But along the way, Lisa detailed a whole set of assumptions that have been created to drive the financing conversation, because we need to plan on what can happen there in order to understand how much it's going to cost, how much we might get back, what kind of investments are needed. So as we go through numbers, we're happy to go back in the presentation and say this is where this assumption comes from. But that's really how we got to these numbers. And I just want to, you know, before I give it to Ken, I want to say so. The fundamental issue is we're budgeting a maximum of $80 million of tax increment financing to acquire the post office site. And that corresponds with some sense of what they're going to need to acquire and build a new facility in the region. That's a maximum. That's an up to. Our goal is obviously to come in under that. In addition, we're budgeting $35 million for a lot of the investments and public benefits that Lisa's talked about in the framework plan. Once again, that's a round number designed to say, okay, we want to have a flexible pot of money that we can apply to the infrastructure, open space, affordable housing needs, but we don't know exactly how it's going to be spent. So we've taken what was $30 million, right, Tony? 30, 35 in the current budget? 30? What was it? What's
35.
And we've increased it by 80. So we basically have inserted $80 million into an existing kind of fully budgeted River District forecast. And so now we have a deficit. And this is why we're having conversations with the city about a financing plan. The goal here is to maintain all of the existing commitments that we – commitments, I use that term generally speaking. We have some actual commitments and some you know, projects that we'd like to get done. But using that term – to maintain all of our existing commitments and do this project. So that's one of the assumptions we're making going into this, which is we're not coming in here saying we want to trade off between investment in Old Town and doing the post office or an investment in the Union Station, the post office. This is an attempt to meet, to address all those priorities. And I think what we're going to lay out for you is a very reasonable kind of low-risk way of doing that, but that's part of what's going on here is we're saying we're trying to do this with all the existing commitments. Theoretically, you could remove $80 million of forecasted expenditures and put it on the post office. I don't think that's what anybody, either our board wants to do, nor do I hear it from anybody that we've talked to. So that's the challenge in front of us, and Ken's going to walk us through how we're approaching a solution on this.
Thanks, Patrick.
And that's actually a good way to stage the discussion about financing. We have too many projects with not enough tax increment capacity, which is the traditional way in which we would approach financing the projects. And even with that, there's always a timing issue. When do we make an expenditure? When do we get revenues back to be able to pay off a financing that may have helped fund that expenditure? And that's the challenge that we have here. The additional to that, we have some real restrictions on the use of money that we might use to make these things happen in terms of whether they can be used for a particular purpose. We have a lending a credit issue, which creates some impediments on our ability to use our financing tools in a certain way to make these things work. But we also have coming to the table with the post office project some additional new resources. We have a piece of land that can be developed, that can be sold, that generates revenues and resources back into the mix of things. So timing issues, capacity issues, color of money issues, are all at play here in trying to come up with a one, a concept that would work, and then a plan that we think is reasonable, but also has built into it some protections against downside risk that we know might occur and that we have to be aware of, and to make sure that we don't create a downstream problem for the general fund, which is going to be called upon to help make this project happen. So those are the kind of the backdrop framework for developing the concept. On the next page we have in the handout, we talk about financing, we talk about sources and uses of funds. We have three different columns. We have River District TIF in the red on the left side, and the proceeds and the indebtedness that remains in River District would be used for the purposes shown under that particular bar. And one of the big things is that the post office would be acquired with TIF. And if we didn't have the post office, other projects would otherwise be used with that TIF capacity. We have to do that because the nature of the acquisition of the post office project and its potential for private use and the way in which we would develop that, if we were to, for example, just do a general fund-backed line of credit to buy the post office, we'll run into a lending a credit issue, which would prohibit our ability to facilitate that kind of interaction with a private buyer or entity. When we use tax increment funds, because of the nature of those funds, we are relieved of the lending of credit restrictions. And so what we've had to do in planning this color of money, if you will, is make sure that we can align the right projects with the right funding source. So you'll see under that particular use of TIF that the post office is one of those draws or uses of funds, the remediation of the post office site, Old Town Chinatown Action Plan, the funding of Multnomah County's health services building, and then affordable housing. We also have program income inside of River District, and the program income varies year to year, but it's substantial. And that program income will be used to help pay for interim financing costs as we run forward, and also for property management related costs. So that's an important aspect of sources of funds. The third piece of the puzzle is what we're calling interim financing, which would basically be a new general fund-backed line of credit. That line of credit would be used to help fund other public purpose projects in the River District. Projects that would be crowded out, if you will, by the tax increment financing are now going to be funded with the general fund line of credit. And the reason why we make that switch, again, is we can use general fund-backed line of credit for these kind of public purpose investments and not have a lending of credit issue. So the nature of the funding source aligns with the expenditure type so that we don't create an impediment in terms of our use of that particular funding tool. By using tax increment for the post office site, we don't have restrictions on the use of those funds. That allows us to engage in activities that result in a private transaction. So part of it is this color of money and making sure that we can align the right funding tool with the particular projects at hand. So we've just kind of moved things around inside the River District, taking advantage of a general fund-backed line of credit that would be used to help facilitate those public purpose projects.
And what's the last example of us using a general fund line of credit for a similar purpose?
Well, we use general fund-backed lines of credit quite a bit with PDC. So, for example, most all of the Urban Renewal District projects start out with a line of credit. So council authorizes a line of credit. We use that line of credit to pay for infrastructure costs until such time that when the increment grows to a level where it makes a long-term financing cost-effective and also meets our financing terms, then we take out that line of credit and recycle it.
But this isn't backed by TIF. So what's an example of a general fund line of credit where we didn't have a TIF backstop?
I'd have to think about that, Commissioner, to give you some examples, but I know that we've used general fund backed lines of credit in anticipation of other kinds of development projects at the Rose Quarter for when we first built the Rose Quarter development. So we have generally a development agreement with the developer. We have a set of revenues that we're expected to receive downstream, and we'll do a general fund backed line of credit to help carry those development costs, take it out with the long-term financing. Backed by a stream of revenues that we expect to realize from a particular activity.
We actually, I think we had a line of credit in North McAdam or South Waterfront for the streetcar, for one extension of the streetcar that was ultimately taken out by proceeds from a property sale.
Just conceptually.
Or maybe from a different source. Maybe that was. But anyway, it was taken out by something non-TIF.
And just conceptually, why do we have more flexibility with the line of credit than with the GO?
We could do, in terms of the flexibility of the line of credit, a couple things. One, a line of credit versus a, and we've looked at actually as one of the financing options we would do, some type of a longer-term bond issue, a 10-year general fund-backed bond issue in lieu of a line of credit. One of the problems with that is that a bond issue, we get proceeds immediately, and we start paying interest immediately.